Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, March 14th, 2018. We begin with the news section. Who runs the world? Durham sets up a mayor's council for women. What exactly will it do? Last Monday's meeting of the Durham City Council was, as far as local government meetings go, pretty empowering for the women in the room. It started with a Pledge of Allegiance, led by both Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. The Girl Scouts then stood at the front of the council chambers, wearing their patch-covered vests, while council member Nadrina Freeman, herself a former scout, proclaimed it Girl Scout Week in Durham. Mayor Steve Shewell then read another proclamation recognizing March as Women's History Month. In keeping with the theme, former council member Eddie Davis, who now serves as the city's public historian, recognized local historian Jean Bradley Anderson, whose book, Durham County, The History of Durham County, North Carolina, chronicles the history of the Bull City, including the working, religious, and activist lives of Durham women. Then, members of a newly formed Mayor's Council for Women were sworn in. It feels significant that we're here with a proclamation for the Girl Scouts and a proclamation for women's history and starting our Women's Council, said Council Member Jillian Johnson. We're really excited. It's a great night. There's a palpable sense of excitement around the new Members Council and among its members for the women's group, but what will they put all that energy toward? The council has a broad mission statement to improve the lives of Durham women, but how it accomplishes that goal is up to the members, explains Johnson, who will serve as the liaison between the Women's Council and the City Council. All the women who were appointed have particular skills and specialties that they'll bring, Johnson said. That was something I was definitely looking forward to. These folks who were already committed in Durham in a variety of ways. The Women's Council consists of 7 women covering different geographic and subject areas, as well as 2 at-large members. It came together at the urging of longtime City Council member Cora Cole McFadden, after representatives from several women's organizations came to the City Council as part of Cities for CEWADW, which refers to the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The formation of a Women's Council was among their recommendations for how Durham could improve the status of women. Gloria de los Santos was part of that group. The Durham Director of Action North Carolina and a Women's Council employee, De Los Santos says Durham will be one of just a few cities in North Carolina with such a body. My whole idea was to give women that live across the city a place to voice their concerns, she said. Durham County already has a Women's Commission, and for the first time women make up a majority of the City Council. Having a strong female presence on all these bodies offers an opportunity for robust discussion about the issues facing women in Durham and to advance solutions brought forward by women themselves. Having a majority of women on the council already feels really significant to me in terms of moving toward a more gender parity. Council members can't be everywhere, so having a community voice at the table where people are close to the problem of the community and therefore close to the solution to those problems, I think is really critical for having a functioning and representative democracy. The Council for Women's first meeting is scheduled for March 26th. Johnson anticipates one of the group's first initiatives will be to examine the status of women in Durham across metrics, like pay, that are known to have disparities. While the appointees were already active in their communities, for some, the Women's Council will be their first political endeavor. Initially, only 6 women applied for the volunteer gig, and the city had to re-advertise the positions. Johnson and others began spreading the word and sharing the applications on social media. The response to the second call for applicants was better than she expected. Ultimately, 38 women applied. The enthusiasm is indicative of a surge in civic engagement, particularly among women, taking place across the country in response to the Trump presidency and gerrymandering at the state level. More women are stepping up to run because we have an open misogynist for president, says Johnson. In last year's municipal primary, 14 people, including 6 women, ran for 3 Durham City Council seats. 2 women prevailed. 23 people, including 10 women, applied to fill Shule's council seat after he was elected mayor. A woman was appointed. And according to the News and Observer, there are 116 women running for state legislature seats this year. Local government seems to me like one of the few places left where people feel like they have any power, Johnson said. This same phenomenon is happening nationwide. According to the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, as of late January, there were 446 women, mostly Democrats, seeking congressional seats. About 25% of the elected officials at the state level and 20% of the officials at the federal level are women, according to the CAWP. I commend women for getting out there to do it, De Los Santos said. It is a large commitment, but I think that if we had more women running and winning, we'd have a different political landscape, and it would change the narrative of a lot of issues. The who's who on the Mayor's Council for Women. Nana Asante-Smith. She will represent the public safety sector. Asante-Smith is a Wake County Assistant District Attorney and a Political Action Committee Coordinator for the People's Alliance. She has also served as President of the Durham Crisis Response Center Board of Directors. Nita Allam is a MetLife Project Analyst. She will represent the category of Civil Rights and Justice. She is third Vice Chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party and previously worked on Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Allam, an immigrant and a Muslim, was one of 23 people, including 10 women, who applied for the city council seat that opened up when Steve Shule was elected mayor. Ashley Candidate. She will represent Ward 2. Candidate is a mother, community organizer, and president of the McDougal Terrace Residents Council. In that role, and as an active member on the neighborhood group Moms on a Mission, she has advocated against gun violence, helped operate a food bank, and organized programs in the city's largest public housing neighborhood. Gloria De Los Santos. She will hold an at-large seat. De Los Santos is the Durham Director of Action North Carolina, a grassroots group that works towards social and economic equality. She's been a community organizer for 10 years. I do hope the women who are on this board have political aspirations to want to run for city, county, or state offices, she said. We may have a president here one day. Mina Ezipke, the Ward 3 representative, is an activist, recent Duke grad, and organizer with You Can Vote, a voting rights project of the People's Alliance Fund. As a fellow with Women North Carolina, Ezipke conducted a research project on formerly incarcerated women of color in Durham. Amy Cox, a family nurse practitioner, will represent the housing and economic development sectors. Koch conducted her doctorate work on the health of single mothers living in poverty, particularly those facing homelessness. Health is a component of our economic success, and and our housing success and our economic successes are directly impacting our health. Megan McCurley, the only applicant for the Women's Council who identified as Hispanic on her application, will represent Ward 1. McCurley is the program coordinator for the American Reacts, America Counts at Duke University, which places tutors in Durham schools. She has a background in anthropology and has researched how Latina mothers in Durham engage with the education system. All aspects of life for women connect to education in some way or another, she said. Rebecca Middle, an exhibit and print designer who specializes in social justice issue. She will represent the arts and culture sector. She recently raised more than $60,000 to pay off the debt of Durham public school students who couldn't afford school lunches. Dolly Reeves, a formerly homeless single mother and graduate student, and she will hold the second at-large seat. Last year, she ran in a crowded field for the City Council's Ward 2 office. Our next news article, Steel Trap. President Trump announced tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Here's what that could mean for North Carolina businesses. Klaus Becker, the president of Nerosteel LLC, a steel distribution company based in Charlotte, doesn't know how he's going to handle the Trump administration's new tariffs, which go into effect in 2 weeks. Some of our material is on the water right now. What do we do with it? Becker wonders. 25% is a lot for me. I cannot eat it. In the middle of production, it's a very hard thing to do. Becker isn't alone. Businesses all over North Carolina are bracing for potential losses after President Trump announced that his administration would apply a blanket tax to all steel and aluminum imports of 25% and 10% respectively. For now, the Trump administration has exempted exports from Mexico and Canada for the tariffs. Some of the North Carolina's largest industries, including aerospace and automotive manufacturing, textiles, and chemical production, rely on steel and aluminum, which means the tariffs could have long-lasting effects on these sectors. Wayne Cooper, chairman of the North Carolina District Export Council, warns that the tariff percentage might seem marginal on the surface, but they become exponentially more significant as they stream through local markets. When you increase the price of the raw material, it isn't just the raw material, Cooper said. It's extrapolated and multiplied every time that raw material gets processed and shipped. Everyone adds a little bit extra to it. That's significant when you consider how many North Carolinians are employed in companies that rely directly on steel and aluminum. By MarketWatch estimates, about 163,000 people. Further complicating matters, allies and adversaries alike have made clear that the tariffs will be met with swift retaliatory action. Even the European Union vowed to place heftier taxes on everything from cranberries to bourbon to T-shirts coming out of the U.S. So exporters in North Carolina aren't safe either, since a trade war would almost certainly lead to higher taxes on outbound products. That doesn't bode well for residents of Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, which generated a combined $5.4 billion in export in 2015. Retaliatory tariffs wouldn't only touch wealthy CEOs and one percenters. There were more than 9,500 small and medium-sized good exporters in North Carolina in 2014. And those businesses account for 88% of all the state's exports, this according to the Trade Council administration. That means that working-class families and small-scale entrepreneurs may take the brunt of any retaliation. One high-profile local industry that is expected to get dinged by the tariffs, craft brewing. In a press release, North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild Executive Director Andrew Lemley explained, from equipment costs to packaging material costs, these proposed increases can put a chill on one of the fastest-growing industries in the state. Aluminum cans are obviously a huge production cost, but nearly every aspect of production, including fermentation tanks, kegs, and draft equipment, would cost more with the tariffs in place. These increased prices might not put a brewery out of business, but they could reduce a brewery's ability to expand. And all of those added costs will likely be passed on to consumers. Trump's tariffs are anathema to many free market conservatives, including U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, who posted on his website, quote, "Our response needs to be methodical and surgical so we aren't inadvertently punishing American allies and sparking retaliatory tariffs that could slow down our economic momentum," end quote. The president's decision also prompted this top economic advisor, Kerry Cohen, to quit. While all of this plays out, Becker is trying to figure out how he's going to keep his company afloat. "I have to gather my thoughts a little bit," he said, "especially the shipments that are on the water are a big concern. And I have to talk to my suppliers and see whether they can stop the production for the time being. I don't know yet how to absorb that." Here's an insert article, a news brief, fighting words. Durham County District Attorney Roger Echols forcefully responded to comments made by Judge Fred Battaglia last week, in which Battaglia asserted that the assistant district attorney who prosecuted the protesters accused of dismantling a Confederate monument last summer is inexperienced and third string. Echols put out a press release Monday defending Amisha Cooper. "These comments were inappropriate, unnecessary, and accurate," Echols wrote. "At a time when women, especially women of color, are still marginalized, it is unfortunate that a member of the judiciary would refer to any woman with such little regard." Battaglia was explaining to the Durham County GOP why he hadn't convicted three protesters tried for damaging the monument last month. He dismissed the case against two and acquitted a third. The next day, Echols dismissed the remaining cases. "She's a nice lady," Battaglia said of Cooper, "but you can't go into the NCAA tournament with your third string." Battaglia told the Republicans he made his decision based on evidence that he stood by his rulings. Two videos shown during the trial didn't allow for the clear identification of any of the three defendants, he said. Cooper has more than 5 years of legal experience, and since joining the district attorney's office in 2015, has been promoted to the Superior Court Property Division, according to Echols' press release. As far as Battaglia's assertion that Cooper had no help in the courtroom, Echols said that any narrative that implies that assistant district attorneys are neglected if and when they need assistance is misleading and inaccurate. The next article, Seeing Green. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles co-creator Kevin Eastman was just going for an underground comics career. He started an independent pop culture dynasty instead. You can't create a comics dynasty on purpose. In fact, it seems helpful not to try. Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, all were cranked out by middle-aged day jobbers on deadline. They were intended to fill a bit of newsprint and then make way for the next fantastical character, not to permanently lodge in the pop culture pantheon. In the 80s, Kevin Eastman set out for a modest career in underground comics, which is a reasonable goal when you've co-created a book about anthropomorphic turtles who learned martial arts from a talking rat and who hang out in a sewer with a pretty TV reporter. Imagining that this premise might birth an enduring multimedia phenomenon would not have been reasonable, to put it mildly, but that's just what happened. Eastman and co-creator Peter Laird revolutionized the comics industry by ducking around the superhero monopolies and self-publishing in black and white with wild success at a time when this was unheard of. They still own the characters to this day, after all the movies and cartoons, the toys and costumes, and the Turtles are still in print, now in color, and published by IDW. Eastman is one of dozens of creators, also including indie stars like Brandon Graham, and mainstream fictions like Walt and Louise Simonson, who is heading to the North Raleigh Convention Center for NC Comic-Con. Oak City this weekend, we're waiting for him. We reached Eastman at his home studio in San Diego, where he was working on sketches for a Batman-TMNT crossover. He discussed how Heavy Metal magazine inspired the Turtles before the Turtles brought him Heavy Metal. He's being sued over the word cowabunga by Buffalo Bob from Howdy Doody and his favorite bits of Turtle-abilia. Indy's question. You were a reader of self-published comics before you took self-publishing to a new level with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. How did you discover independent comics at a time when they were less easy to find than they are now? Eastman answered, I grew up with what was in the spinner racks at the local drugstore, but then came along Heavy Metal magazine. In 1977, I bought the first issue. Heavy Metal published some amazing European talents, but they also published American underground comics. I really flipped out over Richard Corbin, who's definitely my number two influence after Jack Kirby. He was such a fantastic and bizarre stylist. It pushed and stretched the imagination in so many ways. In my search for Corbin material, I went to the Million Year Picnic in Harvard Square, and they had this massive underground comic section. Most important, I found Dave Sims' Aardvark Vanaheim publishing Cerberus. Reprints of underground comics from the 60s and 70s, coupled with what the new guys like Dave Sim were doing, threw in a dash of Heavy Metal that really pushed me forward to what I wanted to do in comics. Question. You bought Heavy Metal in 1991 and edited it for 15 years, and you're still the publisher. Was that like a childhood dream come true? He answered, oh my goodness, yeah. I joke that if you think about it, my discovery of Heavy Metal in 1977 led me to self-publishing. And then when Peter and I created the Turtles together, because we owned and controlled all things Turtles, we also profited from it. Heavy Metal helped me create the Turtles, so I could then buy Heavy Metal. Next question. When you and Peter Laird started publishing the Turtles comics, did you have any inkling that they might become a multimedia pop culture icon? Or did it just seem like this totally niche and crazy thing you were doing? Oh yeah, we definitely knew, and he laughs. No, of course not. If you look at the first issue, it was a complete story. We didn't think we'd sell that many copies or do another issue. We just deeply loved the idea and had so much fun doing the kind of comic book we wanted to read. We thought it was a fun homage and parody of comics, something we had to get out of our system. When it started selling, people at comic shops and fans started writing us saying, what are you going to do issue two? It came out in January 1985, and we made enough money. I think we sold about 15,000 copies to pay rent and draw comics full-time. I point to 1985 as the year the dream came true, this lifelong fantasy we used to tell our parents about, drawing comic books for a living. And he took Lichu with that mortified look like, oh my goodness, we're going to have one of those kids who never moves out of the basement. By the time Hollywood came knocking at the door of the black and white comics boom, we were selling about 100,000 copies an issue, which was mind-blowing. Next question. You didn't make up the word cowabunga, but you might as well have. How did that phrase enter the Turtles' lexicon? How did you make up that slang? He said, it really came out of the animated series. If you look at the comics, there were kind of funky pop culture references like Casey Jones saying, Goongala, Goongala, which is something Tarzan said whenever he wanted an elephant or a lion to do something. I remember watching Beach Blanket Bingo and these Saturday morning matinee movies with this California surfer dude thing going on. Growing up in the woods in Maine, it was about as alien as you can imagine. We just riffed on that cowabunga evolved with David Wise, the writer of the early animated episodes, and became the catchphrase that caught on. We got sued by Buffalo Bob from Howie Doody. The questioner said, right, I read that's where the term first came from. He responded, yeah. He said we basically stole it. I had never seen it. It was before my time. We were like, no, we stole it from Annette Funicello. I don't know if it had been transferred into public domain or common usage, but the case was dismissed. Let's put it that way. Next question. A lot of our readers will know the Turtles from the movies and the cartoon more than the comics. How are the comics different? He answered, the original comics were really written for Peter and myself, intended for an older audience, though neither of us are huge fans of really gory stuff and swearing, but it had a bit more edge to it than what mainstream comics were doing. When we adopted some of them into the first cartoon series, we knew this was for a much younger audience, and a number of things were softened. The first cover, when I painted the Turtles in color, they had all had these red bandanas. When they wanted to do them toys and cartoons, they said, can we come up with a way to tell them apart better? Peter came up with the idea of different colored bandanas, which I thought was awesome. The kids' version reached a much wider audience. It was years and years until a lot of those initial fans of the cartoons discovered the comics. We kind of got them at a young age when we were buying the toys and watching the cartoon. And when they got older and still had passion for the Turtles, they discovered this older audience. It's so humbling and cool when we do conventions and we see parents who were fans of the original series, and their kids have now discovered the Turtles through Nickelodeon's cartoon series, all dressed up together. And a final question, with the incredible amount of turtle stuff out there, do you have any favorite toys or properties? He said, absolutely. The first live-action movie, directed by Steve Barron, with incredible costumes by Jim Henson, I thought was a perfect blend of the original black-and-white series with the humor of the animated series. And the first round of toys in 1988... I remember when Peter and I stumbled into a KB's Toys in Springfield, Massachusetts, and saw them for the first time. They would do Turtles and different characters, and the Star Trek Turtles. I was a huge Star Trek fan growing up, so I loved that. And of course, nothing could take away from what Peter and I originally did, working in the same room, passing pages back and forth, because that's where it all started. We turn now to the indie food section. The Caretakers. Douglas Day's family has owned his farm for more than a century. Now it will be protected from development forever. Tucked back off a winding robe in Rougemont are 24 picturesque acres recognized as a century farm by the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. This designation isn't unique. There are 4 Durham County farms in this program and more than 2,000 in North Carolina. What is noteworthy, however, is that LM&D Farm is the only century farm owned by people of color in Durham County. According to Andrea Ashby, Director of Public Affairs for the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, the Century Farm honors pay respects to the hard work and families put into their farms and the accomplishment of keeping a farm within a family for a century. In order to gain the designation, a farm must have been in the possession of a family for 100 years or more with documented proof, although a family doesn't necessarily have to farm it themselves. Some no longer farm the land personally, but they know the stories, the struggles, and the triumphs of their great-grandparents, grandparents, and parents, and take tremendous pride in that, Ashby said. LM&D farm owner and caretaker Douglas Day knows the stories well. He says his grandfather, Lucius Glenn, purchased the land from a white family in 1903. His grandfather walked all the way to Durham and back that day to purchase what Day was told was then no more than a rock pile and a big briar thicket. The Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services recognizes records dated from 1905. In the 1920s, prisoners spent time clearing rocks off the land, Day said. Despite these efforts, rocks remained a fundamental part of the Glenn's farm for long afterwards. Day encounters them still. I believe there will always be rocks in these fields, he said. Sometimes I think rocks really grow in this place, just like weeds do. Like the family struggle against the rocks, and also battle when Day reflects as a different point in history, to the hard times like the First World War and the Great Depression, when most people, especially people of color, were leaving the farm and going to the cities and the north looking for work, he said, Lucius and his wife Mary decided to ride it out. Lucas and his wife decided to work it out. They said his grandparents' farm was successful because Lucius and his wife Mary were self-sufficient. While they grew tobacco as a cash crop, there were no guarantees their crops would survive or how much money they could bring in. To make sure their family was taken care of, they grew a multitude of other crops and raised animals for their personal use or to trade for other necessities in Richmond or Durham. Mary also taught in a one-room schoolhouse. A Marine Corps vet who spent time in Vietnam, Day never intended to become a farmer. He grew up on the property he now owns, in close proximity to his grandparents, but decided he wanted to see what else was out in the world. Being in Vietnam, however, changed his mind. He decided that if he made it out, he would come home. In 1981, Day inherited the farm. Since then, he worked tirelessly to continue his grandfather's legacy. When his grandparents' former home was struck by lightning in 1994, he built a workshop in its place and kept the old chimney as a monument to where his grandparents started their family. Day remembers how life used to be on the farm. He points out where old trees once stood, where the smokehouse used to be. Today he keeps beef cattle on the land, raises fruit trees, and maintains a garden. The key to keeping a farm, he said, is consistency. Recently, LM&D Farms received another accolade. Durham County's Farmland Protection Program has granted the farm a conservation easement. This means that the 24 acres of farmland will never be subdivided or sold for development. It will be protected indefinitely. Ashby also says Century Farms provides immense value to their communities. These farms and the commitment of these families to keep them in the family ensures that future generations have access to the land resources that are needed for food production, she said. Day is doing just that, preserving valuable land for posterity. But he does it for the memory of a past generation. This isn't about me, Day said. It's about my grandfather. He's the owner of this place. I'm just the caretaker. Also from the food section, against the grain. Trump wants to roll back healthy dietary standards for cool school lunches, but some local schools are sticking with Obama's plan. Policymakers, the medical community, and education officials may have the best intentions and the most up-to-date nutritional information for feeding school kids, but those kids must actually want to put said food into their mouths, or it's all just a giant bureaucratic waste of money and effort. Last November, I visited Northside Elementary School in Chapel Hill, which is a part of the Chapel Hill-Carborough City school system. I went there to write for the Indy about the history of the school lunch and the way schools were addressing the 2010 Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act, signed into law by President Obama. It set new standards for fruits, vegetables, whole grains, sugar, sodium, and fats in school lunches. To meet them, the district hired food service contractor Shartwell's to manage its nutritious programs. March is National Nutrition Month, and last Thursday, McDougal Elementary School held an event to celebrate National Whole Grain Sampling Day, a push to expose more Americans to nutritious whole grains. Liz Cartano, the Shartwell's Director of Dining at CCHCS, along with District Chief Jordan Kaiser and dietitian Lynn Prevett, were joined by Jay Zabrowski. "Call me Chief Jay-Z," he said. He's from In Harvest, a Minnesota company that provides rice, grains, legumes, education, and recipes to food service institutions and sells in bulk to places like Whole Foods. The entire student body attended the event, 564 kids from pre-K to fifth graders. It was a good opportunity to find out how these nutritional efforts were going over with the end consumer. The children were served samples of lime cilantro quinoa with fresh greens, tomatoes, salsa, low-fat cheddar, sour cream, and a couple of whole grain tortilla chips on top. But did the kids like it? Common wisdom says kids don't like unusual food. They want to stay with their culinary comfort zone of macaroni and cheese, pizza, and chicken nuggets. They want artificially colored and flavored, sugary, fried fall food. Different is scary and weird. At the event, a large sign read quinoa on one side and had the phonetic pronunciation on the other. The plan was to show the children how to pronounce the word after their hilarious failed attempts. But because of in-class nutrition discussions, most of these kids were not completely unfamiliar with whole grains, and many had eaten more varieties at home. The majority was familiar with canola's pronunciation. Many of the kids were nutritionally savvy, with adventurous palates. Counterintuitively, Kaiser said, the younger the diner, the more open to experimenting. They've learned from past events that older kids are not nearly so open to the new flavors and the texture. Of course, even among the quinoa kids, many list classics like pizza, hot dogs, and corn dogs as favorite cafeteria foods, and they will always be picky eaters. One little guy, barely nibbling a single chip, declared he didn't like anything in the sample. He explained that he doesn't like vegetables, not many of them. He likes meat, just meat. A T-Rex second grader. Privat acknowledged that schools' inability to mandate healthy standards for lunchboxes, but the policy of teaching about and serving healthy food seems to be working. McDougall faculty members say that the majority of home-sourced food is actually pretty wholesome. Even the snacks are usually fresh fruit and raw veggies. In elementary school, I had a Little Debbie brownie every day. Right about the time my first school lunch story was printed, the Trump administration, citing food waste and schools experimenting hardships and obtaining whole-grain-rich products suitable to students, loosened the limits on fat, salt, and sugars, and instituted a procedure for states to grant exceptions to the mandate of serving whole-grain-rich foods, with the date of full compliance set for the 2020-21 school year. American Heart Association CEO Nancy Brown disagrees with the administration's assertions. In the past 5 years, nearly 100% of the nation's participating schools have complied with updated school meal standards, she said, when the administration proposed the rule modification. Kids across the country have clearly benefited from these changes. Many districts, including CCHCS, have decided to stick with the more stringent nutritional benchmarks. But it's more expensive to feed healthier meals. And with budget cuts coming from all sides, school systems may choose their cafeterias as places to save money. Aristotle said, "Give us a child till he's 7, and we'll have him for life." It's not only true of philosophy, but of nutrition as well. Unfortunately, by lowering dietary standards in schools, that vital window of opportunity may be closing, and the program made so far will have been squandered. Now from the indie music section, branching out. Despite her English punk and pop pedigrees, Holly Cook creates her own world in easygoing reggae. To know Holly Cook is, for better or worse, to start her family tree, although she gets tired of talking about her parentage. "The most boring question is probably about my dad," she tells me via phone, moments after I ask about her family. "I get it. I understand that it is something that interests and intrigues people, but I just don't think it is hugely relevant to what I do or how my music career has gone. Especially because it is the first thing people ask. I'd read that people have asked me, 'How are you?' or 'What did you have for breakfast?'" she said. So, who is her dad? He's Paul Cook, the drummer of the Sex Pistols. Her mother is Jenny Cook, who was a backup vocalist for Culture Club. Her godfather is Boy George himself, and Johnny Rotten is a close family friend. However, because of her musical friends and family, there was no doubt she'd go into music herself. Interested in performance, dance, and songs from a young age, it didn't take long for her to realize that music was her passion. She's always eschewed any nod to her familial roots, claiming that making reggae was a subconscious attempt at striking out on her own. "It was just unexpected, for whatever reason," she says, laughing. It was another family confidant who got Cook into the recording studio when Cook was 19. The Slits Ari Up asked her to sing on a track. From there, Cook joined the Slits, touring with a band and contributing her song, "Cry Baby," to their 2009 record, "Trapped Animal." Through that experience, Cook gained the confidence and knowledge to launch her own music career, and she's been on the rise ever since. In 2011, her eponymous debut received high praise, as did her 2014 album, "Twice," which landed her in Mojo Magazine's 50 Greatest Reggae Albums of All Time, a list at number 31. Cook was not only one of the few women on the list, but one of the very few living artists on it. In January, Cook released her third LP, "Vessels of Love." She says the record came out of a dark emotional time, but she broke through anxiety and heartache and released a group of songs about positivity and affection. The motivating Angel Fire kicks off the album, proclaiming, "We're feeling proud. We make lots of sound." It would paint a picture of people who will not back down. "My heart's desire is strong and true," she repeats over a laid-back reggae beat, layered with bright trumpet, glittering chimes, and rolling drums. "On Together," she sings, "we're rising higher, we cannot fall, there is no room for the enemy." While echoing synths and drum machines swirl around her gentle voice, "Together we are powerful," she reminds listeners. The positivity emanating from her songs, along with her fresh approach to reggae, makes Vessel of Love essential for anyone facing burnout from the turmoil of any issue, personal or political. Cook credits her current success to forging her own path rather than succumbing too heavily to the influences of her parents or her peers. "Stand your ground and believe in yourself. It can be really hard, especially when there are so many people around you," she said. "It's a hard balance knowing when to trust others and yourself." But sometimes maintaining that balance of trust requires a change of scenery. After working for more than 7 years with the label Mr. Bongo, she moved to Merge Records to release Vessel of Love. "It's a real different experience with an American label. That's really cool," she said. "They haven't figured out that I don't belong there yet. I'm not cool." With the new label behind her, Cook's sound has expanded beyond a more traditional reggae classification, including electronic elements, synths, and more. Much of her new sound is owed to producer Martin Youth Glover, who has worked with Paul McCartney, The Verve, Despeche Mode, and others. The album feels like a hopeful reassurance in dark times, which Cook says was fairly unintentional. She often starts writing with a melody or instrumentals, adding lyrics to fit the atmosphere of the song later. The songs wound up falling that way. It's funny because this album came out of such a dark emotional time. "A lot of the subject matter isn't necessarily light and joyful," she said. "The process of making the album was therapeutic and cathartic and necessary. I was healing myself at the same time." We turn now to the indie stage section. Watering the Grassroots. In the inaugural Bull City Black Theater Festival, underserved African-American theater artists go straight to the audience they richly deserve. Jamaica Holloway Burrell has to stop and catch her breath for a moment. "I've caught her between appointments in a busy day, moments before she rushes into a rehearsal for Playmakers Repertory Company's upcoming world premiere of Leaving Eden." Over the last month, Holloway Burrell has been assistant director for that production, while also producing what promises to be a groundbreaking two-week festival devoted to developing black theater artists and audiences in our region. You'd be out of breath, too. This week and the next, the Bull City Black Theater Festival will fill Man Bites Dog Theater with shows, workshops, masterclasses, seminars, and conversations on stage movement, playwriting, acting, and the past and present of black theater, locally and nationally. Holloway Burrell is still adding events as we speak, juggling rehearsal schedules and performance shot lots for almost 30 stage artists in a dozen presentations, all while managing the responsibilities of that gig at Playmakers Rep. There will be performances, of course, stage readings by the region's three main black theater troupes, M-O-J-O-A-A, Performing Arts, Black Poetry, Theater, and Holloway Burrell's own Black Ops, of works by three local black playwrights. But the other offerings are notably different from traditional theater festival fare, Nakisha Coffey's workshop on acting entitled The Playground is open to people who've never studied acting and even those who have never stepped on stage. Coffey, a veteran actor who's performed with companies including Little Green Pig and Bartlett Theater, says many people who have the talent to be on stage don't know it because they don't have formal training or they're afraid of auditioning. Rita Green and Robin Carmen Marshall's session, Next Act, focuses on raising up the voices and stories of 50 women and older, of women 50 and older, a demographic for which American theater has shamefully been of little use. We have so much to say, and we're just not being heard, says Green, an Obie-winning stage and film actor who recently appeared in Man-Made Dog's Life Sucks. These events are meant to provide access to tools, techniques, information, and support, not only for those already in the field, but for those just beyond the doorway. Looking through, as Holloway Burrell says, she and her co-organizers want the festival to gather, nurture, train, and provide, and more, to give them more exposure for black theater artists, while building an audience who will act as our collaborators. Director and local black horror historian John Harrison calls it watering the grassroots. The stakes are high, as the festival could be a prototype for a more permanent regional entity. A group of artists is considering starting an African-American theater collective with its own black box theater, making the festival a little laboratory for us to see what something more fully fleshed out might look like, says Holloway Burrell. It's painfully obvious that the community of black theater artists needs such an organization. Over the years, the region's academic, independent, and community-based theaters have provided inconsistent support, at best, through isolated productions and initiatives. During them, the riches of this community have shown, only to fade upon their conclusion. The existing theater infrastructure hasn't developed a sustained relationship with black artists and audience, Harris says. Frances McDormand put it best during the Oscars. We need an inclusion writer as well. There's a critical mass of black performance in our area. But looking at the upcoming season, what is there for them to do? Green came of age as an artist through the black arts movement in New York during the 70s, performing on and off Broadway and working as a film and television actor in Los Angeles before moving to this area in the last decade. I'm astonished at the talent here, she said. Green likens the experience to being back at Howard University. People live, eat, and drink theater here. I haven't experienced that love and dedication for so long. As Marvel's Black Panther leaps over the 1 billion mark in ticket sales, the hunger for black stories told by black people, for us, by us, about us, and near us, in the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, is undeniable. The audience is out there, and the money is out there, Harris said. The community is ripe to receive it. The lingering question, according to Holloway Burrell, is how a community of artists, historically limited by oppressive or disinterested structures, can share resources, find their own direct access to audiences, and function as holistic community. We'll get to the crux of these inside the festival, she said. I can't wait to have those conversations. Now from the indie screen section, Wild Horses. How a small-time municipal employee embezzled enough money to turn herself into a world-class horse breeder and got away with it for decades. Rita Crunwell, a comptroller in Dixon, Illinois, embezzled $53 million from the small city's coffers over the course of decades. The largest municipal fraud ever recorded in U.S. history. It wrecked Dixon's economy. Even more improbable is what she did with the money. Cornwell, an unassuming government employee by day, turned herself into one of the world's richest quarter horse breeders by night. A jet setter who spent millions on luxury motorhomes, clothes, jewelry, and ranches. She also owned dozens of world champion show horses. After her arrest, many media accounts focused on the sensational, the nearly 800 trophies, the 400 horses, the champagne lifestyle of fur coats and lavish parties. After Cornwell pleaded guilty in 2012 and was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2013, the media furor died down. But how she was able to steal so much money, unnoticed, for so long that the city of Dixon had to slash its budget and borrow to keep afloat. New documentary, All the Queen's Horses, which has a free screening at North Carolina State on March 19th, aims to answer that question with glamorizing or diagnosing the perpetrator, sidestepping the sensational aspects of the case to explore the conditions that created the opportunity for Cornwell to embezzle so much. According to the film's director and producer, Kelly Rich Diamond Pope, these conditions aren't unique to Dixon. They mirror what fraud investigators around the country frequently find. A trusted person controlling all aspects of an organization's financial management, a lack of institutional financial literacy, and few internal controls. This is not the Rita Cornwell story. This is the story of how a person can execute a fraud like this, how it can happen everywhere and be committed by anyone. It's a story that Pope, a Durham native, who is now a professor of accounting at Chicago's DePaul University, is uniquely suited to tell. Along with her teaching and research, she has worked as a forensic accountant who investigates fraud and embezzlement. Pope said, "These fraud costs cost us all. They erode our sense of government and our participation in the process that all we have to pay for." The powerful message in this film is that we all have a little Rita in our organization. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program isn't intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.